Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features part one of an interview with Don Ressler, as well as four primary sources topics we're going to be covering in a bit. Don is an assistant professor at the Department of Social Sciences and director of strategic initiatives at the Combating Terrorism Center at the U.S. Military Academy in West Point. Aaron, what did you guys talk about during your conversation?
In the first part of the interview, we discussed Don's article in the CTC Sentinel, which came out in mid to late March this year, titled Situating the Emergence of the Islamic State of Khorasan or the AFPAC region. So it highlighted a little bit about who is pledging bayah and who is becoming part of the burgeoning movement inside of Afghanistan and Pakistan region.
All right. And before we get into that part one of the interview, we're going to cover some primary source material. And to start it off, what was released recently covering Jabhat al-Nusra's Dawah activities and their governance?
So since we last discussed primary sources, this episode will have content from June 25th through July 17th. Jabhat al-Nusra had a number of different activities that one could be called under their Dawah and Guidance Office, as they call it. And they started this one campaign called the Victory for Sharia campaign, which kicked off on June 25th. And they're explaining the motivations behind it in one of the videos, essentially to inform people about the religion, helping them know what is permissible and what is not. And this campaign chose seven key topics, including, the dangers of smoking or the dangers of democracy, as well as a variety of other issues. It began distributing different leaflets and putting up posters around towns, as well as playing games with children and giving public talks so that, people would better understand what was going on. A day later, they also had a video about this continuing campaign and explaining how it spread across all of the liberated lands that they had taken over, mainly in the Idlib region in northwest Syria. And in this particular video, they focused on various aspects of the correct Sharia practices, such as praying and female dress. They showed some video footage of them handing out Dawah literature to different drivers. And they noted how that there was sort of a synchronicity to these activities, in that all of the mosques would discuss one issue in the same week, and they coordinated the distribution of printed materials after prayers and hanging up posters in public places. In addition to this, they also had a women's and a youth wing for this. So the women would be essentially doing this activities specifically for women and speaking to them in the streets, whereas the children will be passing out literature in the street with a smile, as they explained. Additionally, there is also a video on June 26th, not specifically part about this campaign, but it was aspects of different Dawah activities that they're conducting as well within the framework of a hadith that Muhammad, or that was reported about Muhammad, where he said, quote, report from me but one verse of the Quran, and it showed various video takes of the Dawah activities that they're conducting, large public meetings with speeches about religion, games and sweets for children, visits to the different shops and distribution of literature, and so-called street Dawah projects focusing on issues such as the correct hijab and women. A few weeks later, on July 10th, Jabhat al-Nusra put out a video about their Breaking the Fast project in rural Hama, essentially the preparation of iftar for different mosques, and highlighting how they're coordinating it with a bunch of different local restaurants and explaining what the specific meals are, highlighting how it's comprised of portions of chicken, rice, and accompanied with labneh and tamar hindi. A day later, Jabhat al-Nusra actually had a governance type of activity in one of their releases, where it was mainly about the reformation of a road and essentially contrasting the dilapidated state of the main road in Sarmada before the reparation project, and then showing them being involved in cleaning it and resurfacing it, and then interviewing some residents expressing their approvals and thanks for this project.
And during this time period, what has come out regarding the Islamic State's governance activities?
So the Islamic State, of course, has been involved in a variety of governance projects as well. And over time, we've seen that it's become more and more sophisticated. In this particular time set, we saw them opening up a new halal slaughterhouse in Wilayat al-Khair, or the Deir ez-Zor region, which was established to ensure that animals are slaughtered correctly according to, you know, the particular practices, as well as vets are on hand and in attendance to monitor the health of the animals and the quality of the meat so that nobody gets sick from it. And as for those who follow their social media posts really closely, their Hizba team goes to a lot of the markets sometimes and makes sure that there's not rotten and spoiled meats that are being sold to the locals. So this highlights that there's this full process that they're trying to undertake. On July 6th, the Islamic State put out a video about the services department in Sarin about restoring the water and electricity supply and improving communications and transport networks, as well as establishing an industrial zone in the area. And then the footage highlighted them fixing a water pump, cleaning and resurfacing roads, building a new roundabout, fixing electricity and streetlights, and building fountains, among other things. And similar to, you know, the Jabhat al-Nusra videos, they interviewed some residents to show that people were, you know, happy about these changes. In one particular resident's case, he highlighted how there are tangible improvements compared to those who had previously been in charge. Similar to Jabhat al-Nusra as well, July 15th, the Islamic State ended up breaking the fast project where its public relations office essentially set up two kitchens, one in Tadmor and one in Sukhna, and this would be in Wilayat Homs. And they provided around 500 meals every day to people, which were primarily prepared in the afternoon and then specifically distributed to people's homes and mosques. And then on the same exact day, they also had a Ramadan competition in the streets, essentially having quizzing children in particular different verses within the Quran. In the video, it showed that no one really got the responses correct on the first time. As a result, it encouraged people to reread the Quran, and then they gave them an easier answer or an easier question to answer. And because they got this right, they then provided them a reward with a copy of a Quran and other religious literature, essentially trying to motivate people to learn even more, and that there would be potentially even more rewards for learning or understanding better the Quran's verses.
And as usual, there have been anti-Islamic State and pro-Al-Qaeda messages coming out. What have you seen over the past couple weeks in that area?
Yeah, it wouldn't be a day or a week without more anti-ISIS messaging from Al-Qaeda-affiliated or sympathetic types of organizations and individuals. So one of the first things we saw in this time period was in July 1st, when Harakat Sham al-Islam, which was essentially originally created by a bunch of Moroccan foreign fighters in Syria, objected to a bunch of ISIS's actions, especially in relation to some of their recent advances against them in parts of Aleppo, talking about how, you know, IS was combining the ideology of the Kharijites and the Shia, having declared most of the Mujahideen and Muslims kufar, having shed the blood of those whose blood should not be spilled, and breaking promises, as well as declaring takfir on whoever disagrees with them. And then highlighting, based on their opinion, that the caliphate and the Baya is invalid and that no one should support them, and that they're a bunch of criminals. A few days later, we saw yet another statement from Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi about the Islamic State, this time trying to explain the arbitration initiative that he had been previously conducting with the Islamic State about a year and a half or so ago, considering all the misinformation and disinformation that the Islamic State has put out about it, and highlighting that it was launched before there was any enmity between him and IS, and that it was not specific to the initiative that Sheikh Abdullah al-Muhaisini had done previously as well, and highlighting how he had corresponded with ISIS for about 8 months on issues, after which they refused him. And after the refusal of this initiative, Makhtizi took his position against them and issued a statement against him. So from his perspective, he was trying to do something sincere, and only after he was betrayed in his mind, he went against them. Another document that we saw came out was from Al-Hikma Media Foundation, which is one of AQAP's media outlets. This is the one that got caught up in the whole spy games issue we talked about previously and has since rebranded. And it came out with a three-part article series called Why Our Choices Al-Qaeda on July 4th. And in the first one, it was highlighting how Al-Qaeda's application of Sharia in Yemen was a good thing, and it was giving the example of a Yemeni man who was able to regain his territory or land that had been lost in an AQAP Sharia court that he had not been able to get from judges during the Saleh era. In the second article that AQAP's Al-Hikma Media put out, they talked about how AQ was an idea and a program rather than specifically a group, and it listed the particular victories and expansion it's had since 9/11 all the way up through 2014, including their increased influence in Syria, Yemen, Somalia, and North Africa, despite the continued killing of many of its leaders through drone strikes. And then the final one was describing a visit to the Al-Razi Hospital in Abyan in AQAP-controlled Yemen, and essentially showing that everybody was equal, and the example they gave was that those who entered the hospitals all gave up their weapons, even senior AQ figures, so as not to distress the sick individuals. And then the last release we saw was from Dr. Abdullah bin Muhammad al-Muhaisini, called The Fifth of Ramadan, which is essentially a response to Abu Muhammad al-Adnani's audio message, the spokesperson for the Islamic State. In it, he was describing sort of the Islamic State's practice of declaring takfir incorrectly upon Muslims, in his opinion, and he compares them to the Kharijites, who killed Muslims based off of their declaration of takfir, and that a lot of these activities showed the true nature of IS, especially this recent audio message that Adnani had put out. And he compares this concealment of their true beliefs to the use of taqiyya practiced by Shia. And he ends his address with a call to the so-called righteous ISIS supporters, who generally want to establish a caliphate and have victory for Islam. And given all of the evidence he's provided, trying to get them to leave the Islamic State and join the other Mujahideen groups, likely in reference to maybe Jabhat al-Nusra or Ahrar al-Sham or the umbrella group of Jabhat Ansar al-Din, though he does note that it's probably pretty difficult to leave the Islamic State's territory at this juncture.
And along with the criticisms of the Islamic State, we of course also have messages coming out defending the Islamic State. What interesting things have you seen there over the past few weeks?
There is one message in particular I found interesting from Sheikh Hussein bin Mahmoud, who's been an ardent supporter of the Islamic State from the beginning. And usually the Islamic State doesn't actually have sort of anti-Jabhat al-Nusra or anti-ISIS messaging, or at least they haven't in about a year and a half or so. They sort of are acting as if they're bigger than it because they're a caliphate now. But you do have this ideologue that put out a release on July 12th discussing the issue of the designation of the Islamic State as Kharijites. And a lot of it is interesting because he's essentially saying that the Kharijites were not as bad as most people were believing, and then also at the same time trying to deny that the Islamic State should actually be described as Kharijites. He provides a short introduction to the Kharijites historically and trying to explain that they're not aliens, but are people who have gone astray, and argues there are two types of Kharijites, so-called satanic Kharijites, whom texts warn us about, as he says, and so-called legitimate Kharijites, who have rebelled against unbelief and ignorance. and further highlighting that the original Kharijites were better than many Muslims today in their understanding of religion and monotheism, or Tawheed. And that anyone who calls ISIS Kharijites is telling a lie against the Prophet Muhammad. And he concludes his release by highlighting that ISIS has made mistakes, of course, but only because it has been so ambitious in what it's trying to accomplish. If it had been doing less, it would have far fewer mistakes, as he explains. And the truth of IS is that it is at last an Islamic state. It is only Kharijite insofar as it has rebelled against established worldly rules and rulers, organizations, and rebelled for the cause of Sharia. So in many ways, this is a different type of argument we've seen related to defending the Islamic State, but also in relation to the way the issue of Kharijites is framed as well. Thanks for coming on to the show today, Don. It's good to have you here.
My pleasure. Thanks, Aaron.
I'm really looking forward to this discussion since it's an area I'm not as familiar with, since I focus more on the jihadis in the Arab world and have been curious to know more about it. And in late March, you wrote an article for the CTC Sentinel titled Situating the Emergence of the Islamic State of Khorasan, which detailed the development of the Islamic State's presence in the AFPAC region. I know it's a lot, so could you unpack the details from this piece, maybe first talking about the general development within the AFPAC region, who the main players are, and what regions they're from in what you call the recognized category up until mid-March when your piece came out?
Sure, no problem. So the development of the, you know, what is described as the Islamic State in Khorasan, the Islamic State's chapter or wilayat in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region, reaches back to, you know, initial developments with in March of 2014, when there were a group of 9 al-Qaeda members who had decided to defect, who were resident in, you know, believed to be resident in the Kunar-Nuristan region of northeastern Afghanistan, and decided that they were no longer happy with the progress being made with al-Qaeda, and they looked over at the Islamic State and decided to join them. And so that was an initial sign that there were some rumblings and that the Islamic State might have some traction in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region. That isn't necessarily a surprise, because, you know, while the Afghan Taliban has always been the main insurgent force, at least on the Afghan side of the border, for, you know, quite a long time, there have always also been individuals within the Taliban, as well as smaller groupings outside of the Taliban, who never really fit within the Taliban's leadership structure or weren't satisfied with the Taliban, you know, itself. You could even make the case that on the Pakistan side of the border, that the development of the Pakistani Taliban from 2007 onwards, and, you know, was a further reflection of the lack of pleasure with the direction taken by the Afghan Taliban in terms of the limiting of their target set to Afghanistan and the coalition, U.S. coalition and NATO forces. So that was one push with the al-Qaeda members shifting their allegiance. Then, you know, throughout 2014, there were some initial signs with a couple of other smaller groups who were based in Pakistan, who decided, you know, again, looked at the Islamic State and what they were doing and pledged their support for Baghdadi, you know, and particularly after he was anointed as caliph. And so this happened, but then you also had more significantly in the fall of 2014, a collection of notable Pakistani Taliban commanders, in particular, one guy by the name of Hafiz Khan Saeed Orgzai, who was the head of the TTP for Orgzai in the Fatah, as well as a collection of other TTP commanders from the area of the Fatah that lies adjacent to the Nangarhar province and the Khyber Pass. And so you had this area where with Orgzai, Hangu, as well as some of the other provinces there or areas there, and the TTP commanders who had, you know, been noted by the TTP to be in control of those areas, in one sort of fell swoop, side with the Islamic State. That was very significant. Then you also had in that collection a guy named Shahidullah Shahid, who was a longtime spokesman for the Pakistani Taliban, who also decided to side, you know, and pledge his support for the Islamic State. Series of chain reactions follows up till January, where this collection of individuals, as well as a broader expanded group, which included several commanders, not that well recognized, but one or two names that were known, at least to people who study this, that, you know, the Afghanistan-Pakistan region in terms of what's going on there, in particular a guy named Saadin Muradi, who had had activity in Logar province, also decided to join. And all these guys in a video statement publicly declared their support and bay'ah to the Islamic State and to Baghdadi in particular. This is obviously well-timed, because then following several weeks after that, the Islamic State releases a message through Adnani, where they formally, you know, establish the wilayat in Khorasan province and anoint Hafiz Khan Saeed as its head. And so, you know, you have at that point a collection of mostly TTP figures, as well as several other commanders from Afghanistan, in particular regions. The regions that were noted were Logar, Nangarhar, as well as Kunar, Nuristan. You know, and about a month later, you have the deputy for the Islamic State was killed in a drone strike in February in the southern part of Afghanistan in Helmand. So it was just, at, you know, at that time, a small but, you know, noteworthy network of individuals that made a bit of a splash because of some of their operational experience and previous ties, who, and they, you know, allowed the Islamic State to claim that at least they had a network there. And it has been interesting to see what they have done or and not done since that time.
Yeah, definitely. Beyond what you described in your article as recognized sort of groups or individuals that have become part of this wilayat Khorasan, could you touch upon a little bit and describe sort of what you talk about as extenders or groups playing the middle and potential sectarian outfits that might want to become more part of this official grouping from your article?
Sure. Yeah, I think one of the interesting things about, you know, the Islamic State and Wilayat Khorasan, you know, in particular, is that because of the strong brand associated with the Islamic State, you know, it, association with the Islamic State provides an opportunity for these smaller groups to maybe contribute in a way that would have helped them to amplify their attacks as well as their other activity. And so association for a smaller group might, you know, in some cases might also be attractive. And so, you know, in thinking about this problem, you know, there's the recognized. And so there's a group of collection of individuals, you know, as we just talked about, that have been formally recognized by the Islamic State and sort of the central authority there. But there's also a collection of groups, which I framed as the extenders, which have pledged, in some cases, some of these groups have pledged formal bay'ah to, you know, Baghdadi. You know, and some of the other groups have just pledged, you know, more softer forms of support and not a formal bay'ah. But what these groups bring is sort of an extension of the Islamic State's network in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region. Primarily, most of these groups are Pakistani. And, you know, what is unclear, though, is whether or not, you know, the formal, particularly those groups that have formally pledged bay'ah, whether those pledges have been accepted. You know, the Islamic State really still has not commented on these some of those issues, nor has the Islamic State in Khorasan. So it's sort of hanging out there as you know, some of these groups like Ansar al-Khalifat wal-Jihad is one of them. It was actually the first Pakistan-based organization to publicly pledge Bayat at Baghdadi, even before some of the other, you know, recognized individuals were formally recognized. So it's unclear as to what their status is. What's interesting about them is that they've actually have been somewhat operationally active in 2014 in different parts of the countries, in Pakistan specifically, targeting you know, a lawyer who defended a blasphemer case, as well as some other noteworthy attacks in places like Karachi. You also have another sort of extender group is a group that's the Pakistani group Jundullah. So not to be confused with the Jundullah group that is no longer really active, but that was active in the mid to late 2000s, focused on attacks or targets in Iran. But this faction of – or this component of Jundullah really is a splinter group to the TTP. And again, it also isn't really clear what their formal affiliation is with the Islamic State, even though they have pledged public bayah to Baghdadi. And what this group has done is they're a bit more sectarian in orientation than some of the other groups in the region. They've targeted Shia shrines in Sindh and polio workers in Quetta in Balochistan province. So they also possess some limited capabilities and geographic reach, which the Islamic State can use to further their cause as well. A noteworthy addition was also the representatives from the Lal Masjid, the Red Mosque, which is close to Islamabad in Pakistan. And so this mosque is noteworthy and famous for the 2007 siege that the Pakistani military laid siege to this facility because there were a bunch of militants and clerics who were held up in this facility and trying to implement Sharia in the town, in the area surrounding the facility, and implement their own laws. And the Pakistani government was criticized for their sort of the harshness of their response. And this, the siege of this facility was really a turning point in the development of the Pakistani Taliban. So what's interesting about this case is that you have one of the leaders of this mosque, a guy named Maulana Abdul Aziz, who is noteworthy in TTP circles. And he came out and made some statements in support of the Islamic State. And he didn't pledge bayah, but still, from a symbolic perspective, that was also noteworthy in terms of the Islam, you know, for the Islamic State, you know, as a signal maybe to perhaps other groups that the Islamic State was gaining steam or might continue to do so. In terms of groups playing the middle, this is actually the area where, since I've written the article, things have changed quite a bit, which is always difficult when thinking about things in Afghanistan and Pakistan about the militant landscape, because it changes quite frequently.
Yeah, there's a lot of fluidity that we've seen over the past decade or so, and in particular in the last few years, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in the article, I talked about one of the groups that appeared, you know, to be playing the middle was a group named Jamaat al-Ahrar. And this group has been led by individuals who also broke off from the Pakistani Taliban because of sort of leadership disputes with Mullah Fazlullah. And in some of their print media in particular, they'd written a couple articles that, you know, where they made some statements that were supportive of the Islamic State and appeared to be sort of hedging their bets, you know, with the Islamic State camp versus the TTP. But what's interesting is since the article came out, Jamaat al-Ahrar has since rejoined with the Pakistani Taliban. That being said, and the Pakistani Taliban itself has actually issued more clear guidance to include a long direct defense or challenge to Baghdadi through about a 60-page statement where they basically attack Baghdadi's leadership and what the Islamic State stands for. So their position is more clear as well. So you know, you have the extenders, many of those groups are, well, they're still all active. And it isn't, you know, there's, again, a lack of clarity about whether formal recognition is will be forthcoming from the Islamic State, about whether they'll be brought into the fold, whether they'll still be sort of hanging out there and, you know, be able to conduct the attacks, which they would likely conduct anyways, providing opportunities for the Islamic State to also claim credit for those attacks through their association. In terms of groups playing the middle, it seems as though less groups are playing the middle, you know, and have sided more with the TTP camp in defense of sort of the old jihadi establishment, in defense of both the Afghan Taliban as well as the TTP and Al-Qaeda. So there's sort of a coalescence around from some of these groups who were, I described as sort of playing the middle, more around the Al-Qaeda camp, in terms of the ideological struggle that Al-Qaeda has been having with the Islamic State. And so, at least this is what they're doing publicly. You know, the challenge with all of this is, well, what are they doing privately, and how do they really feel about these things? And I think that that's obviously a probably more nuanced issue. In terms of Sunni sectarian groups, I think that this is also one of the most challenging areas to sort of peer into when you look at affiliations and relationship between, or potential relationships between, Wilayat Khorasan and, you know, these types of groups. Because, you know, as is well known, both with Zarqawi and now with, you know, Islamic State under the leadership of Baghdadi, you know, there is quite an emphasis that is placed on attacking sectarian targets, particularly Shia. And, you know, there are a variety of different Pakistani militant groups that, you know, to include Lashkar-e-Jhangvi and Sipah-e-Sihaba, who have historically and, you know, had a longstanding interest in targeting Shia, in Shia places of worship in particular, you know, over the last several years. And, you know, so there's, you know, if you sort of step back, it looks like there's shared interest in terms of some of the targeting objectives and priorities in that regard. The issue is that groups like Lashkar-e-Jhangvi and Sipah-e-Sihaba, while they are oriented in that way, they are all also closely tied in some part, at least politically, with some of their base to the Pakistani political establishment. And so it's difficult for these organizations like LEJ and SSP to formally associate themselves with the Islamic State and their you know, chapter in Khorasan. And so, you know, it would be unlikely for them to do so. That isn't to say that by them not doing so, that they won't have some type of relationship, or that they might not support or help the Islamic State in ways that they can. It's just that doing so publicly is challenging because of other political pressures, you know, that might bring, you know, that might have repercussions for those groups, particularly in places like the Punjab.
That's it for part one of Aaron's conversation with Don Rassler. Part two of the interview, as well as our next hashtag social media segment, will be released in a couple days.
In part two, Don and I discussed what has been going on with the Islamic State in the AFPAC region since he put out his article, so from March until now, and then also discussed a little bit with the issues that the Islamic State has been having with the Afghan Taliban, sort of trying to see whether, you know, this movement was actually viable in light of the infighting with them, as well as the drone strikes that have been killing its leaders, trying to situate where the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan and Al-Qaeda fit into all of this and what's going on there, and then concluding with how this relates to U.S. policy in Afghanistan, as well as the Afghan peace process.
If you have any feedback, you can email podcast@jihadology.net or find us on Twitter, where we are @jihadpod. And if you enjoy the show, please leave a rating and review in iTunes, which will help more people find the podcast.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thanks to Don for coming onto the show and sharing his expertise with us. Also, thanks to the podmaster, Carl Moran, for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly, and to Elizabeth Carruthers for helping with background research on the primary source materials. Until next time, I'm out.